Okay, we can begin. A world to do. Today is Monday morning, February 8th, 2016. It's Erev Rosh Chodesh Adar Aleph, and I guess Torah Tzraga is celebrating there down in Eilat. It's an interesting question. The whole question of the Gemara Megillah, which is the real Chodesh Adar, and it has many ramifications. Even though we pass in Halacha, Purim winds up next to Pesach. But on the other hand, you take the question, if you have your side of it, this is a question that has haunted me all my life, because it comes up time and again. When do you hold the yard side? And the truth of the rabbinate, I was a young rabbi, 1961, I was asked this question, and I saw it, some achoikas achronim, and all the frum svarim say, hold it both others. So I told that to a balabas. He walked away behind my back. This young rabbi is off the wall. He tells me to hold Kaddish 2 months. What's he talking about? And I've gotten this shayla time and again. But the truth is, if you daven and you say, what's the difference? You say Kaddish in 2 months. But to give a balabas an answer, you have to be able to give an answer. So machlekes achronim. Logically speaking, if I was a rabbi in a modern Orthodox shul, I would answer the second month. In other words, tie it in with Purim. But also machlekes achronim among the Ashkenazic achronim. But logically, if Adar Bet is Purim, then hold the Kaddish in Purim.
I failed twice, but I'm serious about it. I failed twice.
You failed. You.
So I can do it once.
Excuse me. Yeah, that's the Ashkenaz Achronim Paskin that way. Well, I mean, the Ramah, I believe, Paskin's that way. But there's a Machlekes Achronim, and logically, to a Balabas, if you tell him Purim is Adar Sheni, and the Yod side is Adar Rishon, he's perplexed, and rightfully so. But the best thing, you hold it both, fast twice. Well, that's beyond my abilities. Okay. Okay, first of all, I wanted some new information. Rabbi Chesky Edelman, our shaluach in the state of Washington, so he writes, this past Shabbos, we had our monthly Shabbos morning minyan. While we did not have more than 10 men when we reached Barco and Chazaras HaShatz, unfortunately, three of the men were not Jewish. Their wives are Jewish, so we had no minyan. Thankfully, a 10th Jewish man arrived and we were able to have Kriyas HaTorah and Musaf. However, the Gabbai was not familiar with all of the people. He tried to give an aliyah to one of the goyim, and I had to cancel it before he was actually called up. The gabbai gave one of the goyim hagba, and I had to cancel it before he lifted the Torah. Then all this happened, that the guy getting hagba was already halfway up to the bim. It was quite an uncomfortable situation. As the guy walked out of the shul, I apologized for the misunderstanding, and he joined us for the kiddush. This is just the day in the life of a shaliach of the Rebbe. Let me tell you, I stand in awe of a person that remains in a community where this is what happens on his one monthly Shabbos minyan. Now, in addition, he tells me that that you mentioned that Chabad houses were independently funded the first 2 years. There may have been a time where Chabad headquarters helped with some of the funds in the first 2 years, but that is certainly not the case today. Before I moved to Olympia 8 years ago, I was told I had to raise $60,000 before I would be allowed to open an official Chabad branch. It took 6 months of knocking on doors in Jewish communities around the world for me to put together the money. My brother-in-law went on Shlichut in Maryland 6 years ago, and he was required to raise $80,000 before he could move. The purpose of raising the money before you go is to ensure your survival before you can start raising serious funds locally, and to prove that you are capable of raising funds. Very fascinating. George Rohr will match funds raised by new campus Chabad centers up to $36,000 a year for the first 2 years. I may not have the details exactly right, but it is something like that. So we have some very interesting information. And let me pick up where I left off. And I have more information that came in, which is fascinating but disappointing. We spoke about a non-judgmental attitude. And there's no question that the Alter Rebbe in the Tanya Perek Lamed Bet develops it way beyond the Rambam. You can find the sources in the Rambam Hilchot Deor. I mentioned this last week, Perek Shishi. And from the Rambam, you look into the Nosei Kelim, you go back to all the Gemaras, and the whole question of rebuke. Do we rebuke? Do we rebuke Bisman Hazer? Do we rebuke when rebuke one health? Do we rebuke when people laugh at us? And the truth is that in the world today, it's very hard to rebuke. We have to be positive and understanding and forgiving, and the Chabad attitude, they specialize in it, but certainly it has caught on. I can't imagine Mismachim of why you going into the rabbinate and not being told you can't rebuke, you have to follow the Rambam and Hilchot Mamrim, Perek Gimel, Halacha Gimel, you know what I'm talking about, where he talks about the Karayim, and you have to show them love and bring them back slowly, not overnight does a person leave his previous lifestyle. Okay. Now, I told the story about my dear friend Jackie Gluck, who just built this beautiful shul in Bal Harbor. And by the way, I'll show you after class, Chabad is now enlarging their shul, which is a block and a half away, a $20 million enlargement. It may wind up being the largest Orthodox shul in the United States. I don't know if anything will ever equal what Tenenbaum built in a suburb of Toronto. But it's going to be mighty beautiful and state-of-the-art. So I mentioned the story with Jackie, which he told me years ago when he came to Bal Harbor. He's davening Shabbos. This guy is davening next to him, and he's wearing a black hat. And he gets to talk with the guy, and he says, "And where do you live?" And he tells me he lives about 25 miles away. And Jackie says, "Where do you stay Shabbos when you come to Bal Harbor?" And he says, "No, I drive." And that made a big impact on Jackie, and he sought out the Young Israel, which then was in offices above a bank, which today is the big shul that he was chairman of the building committee. So Chesky writes to me, "I have heard you tell the story about the shul of Bal Harbor many times. While I don't doubt that your friend is telling the truth, I feel there must be some kind of misunderstanding between your friend and the gentleman with the black hat and gartel. Chabad rabbis are certainly non-judgmental. However, I cannot imagine a Chabad rabbi allowing a person who drives the shul to wear a black hat and a gartel. If it is indeed true, it's certainly the exception to the rule and not the rule." So I just want to mention that I spoke with Jack. I remember the conversation. Absolutely, Jackie said to me that he was wearing a black hat. I seem to remember that Jackie said he was wearing a gartel, but I shall check it out. Be'ezrat Hashem, Jackie has a bar mitzvah of a grandson right after Pesach. It's on a Monday morning, but I don't believe we're teaching that morning. It's right after Pesach. We'll see what the schedule is. And I hope to be at the bar mitzvah, and Be'ezrat Hashem, B'li Neda, I will ask Jackie again. But it could very well be the rabbi didn't know. It's a big congregation, a mob of people. I don't know how close he was to the rabbi, but that Jackie said he was wearing a black hat 100%. The gartel may be a figment of my imagination, although I think I asked Jackie a gartel too, and Jackie said yes. Yes, yes,
Muddy. Why would a rabbi tell him not to? They let people come in dressed, I've seen stuff, all kinds of dressed other ways.
Okay. So anyway, Chesky is a Chabadnik. He's talking within, we're talking without, and I'll try to find out what the facts are. And then I introduced you to a new book last week, the book that deals with the. It's Jerome Mintz's second book. The first book was Tales of Hasidim in America: Sociological Study. The second book already was sociological and historic. stories about what is really happening in America, because from the time he wrote the first book in the 60s to the early 90s, there was a sea change. And what makes the second volume very interesting are the case studies, people speaking, and we'll pick up exactly where we left off a week ago. But I asked, who was Jerome Mintz? And believe it or not, I got an answer. I'm going to put this in my copy of his book because I couldn't get any information on him. I thank Ira Wishnitzer, my student in Chicago. I called my cousin's husband, Dr. Milton Taylor, who taught molecular biology at Indiana University in Bloomington for at least 30 years and is now retired. Milton tells me he knew Jerry, that's Jerome, very well and has a book, a copy of his book on Hasidicism. Milton considered Jerry a mensch. Jerry was born in Brooklyn in a secular household. After high school, he joined the Marines. Then he received a bachelor's, a master of arts from Brooklyn U, City University of New York, a doctor of philosophy degree from Indiana University in 1961. Jerry married Betty, who per Milton probably underwent the Reform conversion. Jerry was a founding member of Congregation Beth Shalom, a Reform synagogue near Bloomington. Milton said that Jerry was very interested in Israel. I asked Milton if he knew how Jerry's interest in Hasidim developed. Listen to this. Milton wasn't sure, but he said that Jerry's initial primary focus was on Spain. And he did his doctorate here. I have an obituary of him. He, carnival song in society, gossip, sexuality, and creativity in Andalusia, published by Oxford International Publishers, and it examines the social and cultural aspects of the carnival in Andalusia. During the course of his career, Mintz produced a series of 6 films on tradition and change in Andalusia. Jerome and Betty adopted 2 boys, both with Korean blood, and had a daughter naturally. Jerry brought up his children to identify as Jews. His son Aaron spent a year on kibbutz in Israel and also joined the Marines like his father. He now lives in Bloomington, Indiana. His son Paul studied science and worked with my cousin Milton in his microbiological lab. Paul is now in Liverpool, England, teaching at a university. Milton says that Paul is active in his temple. Milton keeps in touch with him. Their daughter, Aviva Tevel, lives in Indianapolis. Jerry's wife is still alive but has Alzheimer's. So that's who Jerome Mintz was. And that answers the question of my dialogue yesterday with a man who should be here and is not, and it's very frustrating to the Rebbe, a guy named Alex. When we spoke about Chochmat Yisrael yesterday, I was talking about Chochmat Yisrael, anyone who deals with Shas and Poskim. Today, I don't know of anyone dealing with Shas and Poskim from a Chochmat Yisrael vantage point who is not a Medadek B'mitzvah Talaka Chamura. But when it comes to Jewish philosophy, Jewish sociology, Jewish history, everyone is a king, and you don't have to be a tzaddik to be involved with writing the story of Hasidim. We still don't have an answer. How did Jerry get interested into Hasidim? But the answer may be obvious. He was born in Brooklyn, grew up at a time when most Jews in Brooklyn were chiloniyim, were secular, knew nothing about their religion, when there were still large conservative temples and reformed temples in Brooklyn, and lo and behold, Hasidim started coming in, and not only coming in, but not assimilating, not changing. Okay, let me go one step further. You all know that the most famous undertakings of Chabad to reach out to Jews was, of course, the Tefillin campaign. I spoke about last week what happened at the Kotel, and then I showed you the Satmar Rebbe's Kuntres, which even someone like myself who tries to understand all the different viewpoints in the Torah world, I have my own viewpoint, my own Shita, but I try to understand and explain why they're the way they are, why we have Shtisel. What's so unique about Shtisel? Their lifestyle, and why Shtisel has so caught on with the general population. And Shtisel, you know what we're talking about? The TV series, it's caught on in articles in Mariv and Haaretz and Yediot and Shtisel and analyses. And I know my wife loves it, and my grandson met a girl and she loves it. So I asked my grandson, how does she understand it? You know, if you don't speak Yiddish, you can't appreciate the heart of Shtisel. All right, you do see a translation into Hebrew on the screen, but boy, do I love the Yiddish. All right, let's say you can appreciate a drop more if Yiddish is native to you. So it's very hard to understand the Satmar Rav, how he condemns Chabad, condemns the Rebbe. There are people who think they're tzaddikim down again, they're Rishayim Gemurim, putting tefillin, Alex, I just answered you, I just gave an example. Please pick up the recording of the first part of today's shiur. Bon appetit. Better late than never, as the expression goes. And you're looking at the Kanayin Hara, fabulous students. Bear me out. So the Satmar Rav, I read to you, people at the Kotel, these are secular Jews, pardon my language, but I'm quoting from Satmar Rav, I quoted last week, that all they think about is seducing women, and if they have here Hurim, how are you allowed to put on tefillin? And you all know this is one of the halachot, unfortunately, that I also get constantly, people with operations where their part of their body is not clean, how can they put on tefillin? It's a pretty serious issue. But all right, you tell them to cover up with a blanket. We don't want to stop people from putting on tefillin. So Yomo came to me very triumphantly, and he says, I have proof that the Satmar Rav is correct. How does he have proof? Well, you don't know what happened last week in the Israeli army. The highest ranking woman in the army, Brigadier General Vizel, what's her Tevet, I think the name is today, the original name Vizel. So she issued a directive to all the units when they make up their t-shirts not to do anything that puts a woman down, that is condescending to a woman, etc. Now what are we talking about? Every unit in the army, the part of the secret of running an army and that Jews have achieved this, I've spoken about this many times in public, it's one of the greatest miracles. A unit means that you become one group, you don't argue, you don't fight, and it's one for all and all for one, plain and simple. That's what basic training is all about, and that's what forging pride in your unit, in your people, in your soldiers, because your lives are interwoven, and your lives depend one on the other when you go into battle. To inculcate this feeling, at a certain point, the units design a t-shirt, a sweatshirt, call it what you wish, and they manufacture them for them. They print it, they put it on, they give it out. If I should have remembered, I would have worn a t-shirt today from my grandson's design. They're artists. My wife is an artist. A lot of the grandsons inherit the ability. So the t-shirts I've seen, or am I using the right word, like a Polish shirt, the Polish shirts I've seen all have a psukim on it. Sometimes I tell them you can't do an entire pasuk, putting dots, because you can't walk into the bathroom otherwise. But okay, it's a problem. But it's very inspiring to see what they come up with. Okay? So evidently some units, and remember, I spoke about this yesterday, I told you I wrote about it now in my piece on Meir Kahana, Israel is a democracy. Because Israel is a democracy, democracy has one tremendous advantage. Each and every one of us has a vote. And we can change public opinion, and we've seen, I'm living here 47 years, it's an entirely different country than the country I encountered when I came in Aliyah in 1969. It seems that Netanyahu has a rule, he doesn't appoint anyone to any position of importance unless he's wearing a kippah. That's the only way I can explain it. And when I came in Aliyah, I had a neighbor from 69 on, Moshe Mandelbaum. Jason, make believe you recognize the name, so the ignorant pass for the wise. Mandelbaum House. Moshe and Simcha were both raised. That's their parents' home. So Moshe reached very high positions here, and he didn't wear a yarmulke. He went to work with a hat, and he didn't wear a yarmulke. I would go to visit him. He's without a kippah. I said, Moshe, how can you sit here without a kippah? The frum guy, 100%. He said he has to get ahead. In order to get ahead, you can't wear a kippah. And there were many people who told me the same thing in 1969, 1970, 71. Today you can't get ahead if you don't wear a kippah. You all know who's running the country today. Halavai, they should run it properly with Be'ezrat Hashem. So she is giving Musa, right? So I told Yomo, what are you, so he says, you see, the soldiers think about women. I said, the soldiers think about women, Baruch Hashem, they're healthy young men at an age where they should be thinking about women, where they have hormones, and not all of them learned Musa, not all of them are big in Shas and Paiskim, that they know how to control their emotions. But you can't, and one second. And also, Alex, relax, let the Rebbe handle it. I have the Rebbe speaking in a minute. And not only that, you don't even know who this lady is who wrote the directive. The highest ranking female officer, Brigadier General Kat Aluf, is a Shomeret Shabbos 100%. She grew up in B'nai Brak. She went to B'nai Akiva. She never left B'nai Akiva, basically. Kala Kavod La. Respect. And she wrote it. Kala Kavod. I told my dear Yomo, I will agree that young men at times think of women. I will admit that when I was a young man, I also thought of women occasionally. And believe me, if you see Yomo Shtisel, you see that young guy there can't learn because he has this young girl looking at him. And it's a problem, it's a challenge. We have to be able to overcome and learn and sublimate. And I've given lectures about this. But it's Baruch Hashem, it's a healthy quagmire, we'll put it that way. But believe me, when this soldier goes to the Kotel and he's putting on tefillin for the first time in his life, for the second time, for the third time, for Kedusha V'Tara, he's not thinking about women. And a Talmud listening sent me, it's no longer Rakefet speaking, the Lubavitcher Rebbe said exactly the same thing in a sicha he gave in 1967. It appears Likutei Sicha Tosafot Pashut Ba, page 271, beginning there and going on, and the Rebbe takes on the Satmar Rub's critique, and he, many halakhic reasons, I'm not going to, but for instance, all right, Hihurim, are we sure he's having Hihurim? It's only a Safek. And a person can control himself, and he brings down all the sources that for Suffolk Yehurin you still put on tefillin. And then he speaks about at the Kotel, they're at the Kotel, even if they have Hirurim in Tel Aviv, but now they're at the Kotel, and at the Kotel Hamaravi, they have different feelings. So here you have a source, and the Rebbe goes on to justify his tefillin campaign at the Kotel for secular Israelis as well. And now I want to pick up exactly where we left off last week with the volume Hasidic People by Jerome Mintz. And it's a beautiful, beautiful story. And he makes a very interesting point here, how here he is a graduate student at NYU, and the Chabadnikim have their mitzvah tank outside the campus, And they say to him, are you Jewish? Of course. Did you put on tefillin today? No, I've never put on tefillin in my life. And they take him into the mitzvah tank and put on tefillin. And while he's there, a guy walks in and he wants to put on tefillin. And they say to him, you're a guy, get the heck out of this truck. And they throw him out head first. And he says, he was caught up. We left off right here last week. In an emotional dissonance with my American values. In other words, he's caught here in a crossfire. All of us are caught in a crossfire. Because it's not only American values. What are Torah values? Aren't we taught, be kind, be decent. Anyone you see in trouble, help out. They're human beings. You're a Jew. You have an obligation. What just happened in Lakewood? New, can anyone tell me? The social media is filled with the stories coming out of Lakewood, Ir HaKodesh. New, anyone know? This vagabond, non-Jewish, on the street, some goyim go over to him, and they give him a cup of coffee, but they tell him, if you spill the cup on your head, we'll give you $5. And this poor vagabond spills the cup of coffee on his head, hot coffee, to get $5. And Jews see this from the Lakewood community, and they stop, and they've now raised money. They've rented a room for the man. He shouldn't have to sleep on the streets in the cold winter. And they're taking care of him. And it's gone on TV. It's gone on all the social media. A tremendous Kiddush Hashem. Isn't this what we're taught? This is an American value? But it's a Torah value. It's a Jewish value. It's our value. Absolutely. No. They throw this guy out, you see? He sees the conflict. He's bothered. Yeah, what can you do? Can you put tefillin on a guy? You understand? But he's proud. On the other hand, he's taken in. Boy, these chabotnikim, they have confidence. They're tough. They're rough. They don't take any nonsense. They bounce the guy out in his head. All right? So he's attracted. But I also felt bad for the guy. He might have made a good Jew. Anyway, I want you to think about it. I don't have a black and white answer. You know, how would you act? What would we say to the guy? I wouldn't throw him out. I would say to him, look, I have to explain to you, these are sacred objects that we're not allowed to put on anyone who's not Jewish. But I see you're interested. Are you really interested? Maybe I'll give you something to read, you know. Let's see. I wouldn't throw him out at first. I don't know. It goes against my inner feelings as a Jew and as a human being. You follow me? Both mitzad ger v'toshav. I don't know.
But I'm almost positive that people would have talked to him about the Noah.
Sheva mitzvah. Yeah, we said that last week. And I agree with you 100%. Now, but here he tells us something very interesting. He puts on the tefillin. It was a very powerful experience. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy might. V'ahavta l'Hashem Elokecha, right? And they say it to him in English. And he says it was very powerful. And I said to myself, hey, I've got to include this in my life somehow. Fine. But look at the next paragraph of the interview. But the feeling that I had from the Lubavitcher boy helping me was that he had done his mitzvah for the day. And the actual donning of the tefillin, pulling a blessing into the world, was what interested him. Rather than setting me up as someone who might become an observant Jew. He didn't care what happened to me. It was a short-range view. They didn't take my name. They didn't suggest any follow-up. They didn't say where one could buy tefillin. And I didn't know enough to ask. Even if I knew how to buy tefillin, I didn't know how to wind them or take care of them. it really wasn't a learning experience. I was just producing a mitzvah, but it stayed with me anyway. About 5 years later, my father died. I dug up my grandfather's tefillin in the back of a drawer, and I took them to a rabbi, and he showed me how to put on tefillin and how to wind the straps. That's when I started to become religious. I became religious because of the tefillin. Tefillin is the most exotic foreign artifact in Judaism. There are no known origins describing the straps and the boxes. So I don't know what he means by the end, the no known origins. We have a Masechet Menachot, we have a Masechet Sofrim, Masechet Ketanim. But it's a very powerful interview. You have to think about it. You just put on tefillin. What's the goal? That person, he's happy, put tefillin on. I was in Greg. Remember I told you I was in that cafeteria, restaurant, whatever you want to call it. It's a whole chain. And I gather all the branches are kasher. Some of them are hadrin. They have, some have ravlan. I read about it. I'm very impressed. So we were back there again last week. And once again, I saw the guy, the chabatnik, come in with the tefillin, putting on tefillin. He evidently works the mall, the Hadam mall, must be his hangout. And I saw his face. All right, he puts on tefillin. But there's no follow-up. Who are you? You see, on the other hand, take a look. That one-time chance encounter planted the seeds that years later come to fruition. I have to say, I don't know how Chabad works today, but I can tell you Kirov has become a major scientific study approach. Even you can call it industry. And when you go into a seminar today, they take your name, your phone number, your email, your contact number, everything. Of course, they can't chase you. They can then send you literature and inform you again, we're going to have another seminar, there are going to be classes, they can show you what's available, where you can study. But there's a lot to be said for this paragraph. I wonder today if you walk into a mitzvah tank, what do they call it, a mitzvah mobile, if you walk into a mitzvah mobile, a mitzvah tank, if they don't require you write down your name, your contact numbers, there should be some follow-up. It's a very interesting interview, and it's a point well taken. Now, continuing with the non-judgmental attitude, the Rebbe said something else there which is quoted and I think is as applicable today as when the Rebbe said it. And all my life when I've taught rabbis now for so many decades, I always stress this. How do you bring people to Yiddishkeit? Not just to be non-judgmental, but positivism. If you're going to scare people like Dante's Inferno, you're not going to get very far in the contemporary world. I frankly don't know of any Baal Tshuva who became a Baal Tshuva because he was frightened of punishment in the world to come. If anything, the more you study, the more you learn. Before you knew anything, you were a shogeg, you were an ones, ones rechmana patre. You didn't know anything about Yiddishkeit. Punishment does not bring people closer to Yiddishkeit. But here the Rebbe speaks about the positivism, that you develop an entire spiritual personality. You live not only as an individual, but you live for Klal Yisrael as well. You have a new identity. You're part of B'nai Yisrael, Kahal Yisrael, Adat Yisrael. You are part of a saga, what the Rav used to call, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe echoes him, or the Rav echoes the Rebbe, what the Rav used to call the romance of the Jewish people. And I think here the Rebbe is 1,000,000% correct. And I can tell you yesterday, before Shir, I davened Mincha in Machon Lev, 4 o'clock minyan. So I got there early. I had Dapei Gemara with me. I have, you know, I have my own learning I got to keep up with. So a Talmud of the Kollel from years ago, who today is very active, Rabbi Kutler, very active in Yeshivat HaKotel, so a whole group of American kids there that had just heard a sicha from the new Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Yosef Tzvi Rimon, a wonderful individual, the new Rosh Yeshiva of Machon Lev, a tremendous choice, a tremendous blessing. And you know who I'm talking about. Rav Yosef, you've read his Sfarim. He asked me if I have any of his Sfarim. I said, have any of his Sfarim? I said, I bought endless copies of your 2 volumes on Halacha V'Tzava. As my grandchildren went into the army, those 2 volumes are fabulous. And Rabbi Kutler introduced me to these students. This is my Rebbe with a big introduction. Wanted me to say a few words, told him about some of the books I've written, etc., etc. So you know what I spoke about to these young American kids with this gap year, they call it. Someone gave me a big bracha that no one has given you and Rabbi Horowitz credit for creating the gap year. So I talked to Rabbi Horowitz created it. This was, I know, in my book, and watch me tell the story. It wasn't even Rabbi Horowitz. It was the Torah Culture Department of Rabbi, it was Chamiel and Kroner and Rabbi Horowitz. But I deserve credit because I showed it can work. I set the pattern. What was the pattern? A Rebbe who knows a little bit Shas and Paiskim, and he knows a lot of baseball. You follow, this became the pattern, what we're trying to reach out to, what we're trying to do, what we're trying to attract. And all right, I will take credit for that, absolutely. Rabbi Lichtenstein too, you know, I told you the story more than once over the decades of this kid who's coming into the Gush, and he's a foreign students program. Rabbi Benjamin Tabori was in charge. He should only have Rafua Shlema, Lo Aleinu. He's quite ill. And the Rabbi Tabori is interviewing the kid. And he says to Rabbaran, he says, this kid knows baseball. He says, Rabbaran, give him a farher. Give him a beginner on baseball. And Rabbaran asked him, in which all-star game and in which ballpark did a future Hall of Famer strike out 5 Hall of Famers in a row? I believe the kid knew it was the Polo Grounds, 1934, if I'm not mistaken, and it was King Carl Hubble, and he struck up Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Al Simmons, Joe Cronin, Jimmy Fox, Al Simmons, Joe Cronin in a row, and those were all future Hall of Famers. So you see, this kid already, Rabbaran, knows baseball. This kid already felt at home. This is for me. This is what I'm looking for. Rabbaran also knew all of Shas backwards and forwards, had it on his fingertips, totally organized, etc. So here, very important in outreach, positivism, and you don't frighten people today. At times we would ask Rebbe about Mesilat Yesharim, and I remember in my time we had a feeling the Mesilat Yesharim, it was too filled with Nazirut, with Prishut. You follow me? It was, an American kid couldn't relate to it. And but he had the Mesilat Yesharim, but I always got the feeling the Rav preferred Chovat HaLevavot over the Mesilat Yesharim. And it may be for the very reason I'm alluding to now. And this will also explain to you why the Hasidic lifestyle has caught on, even in Litvisha strongholds. What he said before class, we were talking about the problem of Yartzeit in Adarishon, Adasheni. When do you hold the Yartzeit? And what he says, he holds it twice. So to say Kaddish, no big deal. But he fasts twice. Oh boy. Even though I'm a Litvak, I am frightened by that statement. I would much rather drink a Hilula and the Neshamas Al-Habban and Aliyah on the yard sites that I observe. You follow? So you see here the Rebbe absolutely right, positivism, and color kavod to this chapter by Jerome Mintz. There's a very sad part on page 99, where this Jew who put on tefillin for the first time and 5 years later, and the rabbi and all that happens, and he's become a Shomer Shabbos and Kashrut, and he's trying to get his wife to go to mikvah, and there he doesn't succeed. The warmth, the sincerity, the kindness, the giving almost convinced Millie, that's his wife obviously, that she should follow the law of family purity, almost, but not quite. She almost decided to take up going to the mikvah, but she couldn't quite do it. And I want to comment that this is so important. We mentioned this last week, and I stress it again. A mikvah lady plays a very crucial role. How she receives a young girl coming to mikvah for the first time. And there's a rabbi in Yeshivat Kir at Abba Yid at Tzaddik. I have the honor to say he was my student in the early 70s. He came to visit. Came to visit Israel, and he sits in my classes on Rehov Abba Benel, and he's visiting his friends from Toronto, and I got to see the soul of this kid. His parents were survivors, the hell of Hitler, and here's this kid, and I say to him, Shragai, you will not go back. You will remain here. And he said, what are you talking about? I have tickets. I have to go back. My parents, P.S., he remained. His parents came frightened stiff. It was Israel, terror attacks, all that goes on here. They survived the Holocaust, but he remained at Tzaddik Yesod Olam. He lives in Kiryat Arba. He's had a difficult life. His first wife, who was a student of mine, died at a young age. Thank God he was able to remarry at Tzaddikit and raise wonderful children. So he told me a fascinating story. His sister wasn't that from, you know, came from a Shomer Shabbos home, but Toronto, the 1960s, being raised. Anyway, before she got married, they prevailed upon her to go to mikveh. Here, the rabbinate requires it. I mean, how much they can enforce it. They always ask me when I'm a Sadi Kedush, and I have to send back a copy of the ketuvah with a mikveh settled. You know what that means. How do you say that in English? A receipt that they went to the mikveh. It's called in Yiddish, settled. So, and they refer to it as tzetel. Even the Sfadim use that term. It's something they know, like akutvach, akutin Shabbos. They say, I have a Sfadic neighbor, and he always says, akutin Shabbos, akutvach. He knows, he says he was raised with these basic words. So, he said his sister went that time, and the mikveh lady was so nice, explained everything. And she was mekabelet on herself to always go to mikveh from that moment on. So it's very, very important. Here it's said that his wife didn't quite make it. My only connection now with Lubavitch is that they send appeals for money and I send money back to them. They receive the largest percentage of my charitable donations. They have the Israeli War Heroes Fund and the Lubavitch Youth Organization. So he explains, of course, its connection. And here, too, it's an interesting comment, and I know people like this, that Lubavitch lifted them off the street, literally. They were monkeys on the tree of modern life. And Lubavitch brought them to Yiddishkeit. Not all of them remained with Lubavitch. Some of them, to use the word that this wonderful Jew from Beverly Hills told me, I'm mainstream. You follow? He joined the Young Israel. So they're very market toivet to Lubavitch, but whatever, they went into a different world of Torah where it's not Rebbe-centered as being a chassid is. But you have to give hakarat hatov. And I heard another story very recently about someone that Lubavitch lifted off the floor, and today he's mainstream, the big shot in the shuls, davens three times a day with a minion, and he says, Lubavitch started me on the track. So it's a fascinating story, and you hear what he says with Lubavitch public relations, what they do for war orphans, the joint bar mitzvahs. This is very attractive to a Jew in Chutz Laaretz, because he's contributing to Torah, to Chabad, two Israel and two war orphans. I mean, how can you do a mitzvah like that where you're hitting a grand slam home run with the money? And finally, he quotes the Rebbe at the end of the chapter, and it's hard to believe that Jerome Mintz dealt with all this and married to a non-Jewish woman. I mean, if she converted Reform, it doesn't help. And children, you see what he did, and are they Jewish? They never had a proper conversion, etc. Hard to believe that it didn't affect him, but it's not Shasim Paiskim. And he quotes the Rebbe that the Rebbe time and again put the stress on the deed. That somehow leave the philosophy behind, leave the theoretical stunts behind, the deed will open up the world for you. And here you have an echo of what the Rebbe said in that famous interview that I have the schut that I was the only one in this world that recalled the interview. You know what I'm talking about? Big questions, the Rav and the Rebbe's relationship and symposiums, and I listened, what's going on? And people are speaking, and everyone is, they're creating worlds, Shaloha Yuva Lo Nivra'u. And the Rav himself said so beautifully, that he asked him, remember, how do you feel, Rabbi Soloveitchik, standing on a street corner asking people, did you put on tefillin? And the Rav said, I wouldn't do it. But he said this, great thought and great depth to it. And remember the Rav's words? They're not just asking you to put on tefillin. When they're asking you to put on tefillin, there's a much deeper connotation. Who are you? What are you? Where are you going? Where do you come from? Someone putting on tefillin has to ask questions if he has a mentality above an IQ of 90. And when a Jew starts to ask questions, you never know where it's going to end. And this is the Rav's Torah. I can't elaborate now, but I'll just give you a hint. So you should say you didn't come in vain today, Natan. This is why Chazal were makpid, that the Haggadah is based upon four questions. You can have the whole Haggadah without the Manishtana. What do you need the Manishtana for? Avadim, Ayinu, Lafaron, tell the story, Vigamanu. But no, Chazal were makpid, that you have to teach a child to ask questions. When you ask, to Vikshatam et Hashem, when you start to ask, when you start to seek, when you start to search, you don't know where it's going to end. And many times when a Jew starts asking, he finds the answer, Shema Yisrael. And he quotes the Rebbe here. You know, again, life, things you did. So someone said to me, you know, that talk I gave in Bal Harbor reverberated. I can't believe how many people listened to it and downloaded it, and how, you can't believe how much correspondence and so many Yashar Koyachs. So one dummy says to me, Rebbe, was that the greatest thing you did in your life? And I say, you don't know the Rav's Torah. Remember the Rav's Torah? Every human being is, this is published, by the way, in one of the volumes that the Jewish Agency published, Yemezi Karon. I heard this with my own ears from the Rav at that Yotzeit Russia. And the Rav said, everyone has a shlichut in life. And you should never say you've achieved your ultimate shlichut, because then God calls you in, you have no purpose anymore. So I told him, yes, it was a good achievement, but there are many greater ones I want to do before the Ribbono Shel Olam calls me in. But what was the motto of the movement to free Soviet Jewry? Does anyone remember? Shlach et ami. Right or wrong? Let my people go. Shlach et ami. The marches, the posters, the placards. Let my people go. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe thundered in public time and again. The motto, epigram, is slightly off base. Shlach et ami. What comes next? Ve'yavduni. That if you just take the Jews out of Russia, and they're not going to be observant, that's not enough. Shlach et ami ve'ya'avduni. It's like the anti-Zionists say on Bilu, Beit Yaakov l'chu l'necha, but what about the rest of the pasuk? Be'arch Hashem, that is lacking. So I accept the Rebbe's addendum with grace and with pleasure. And Baruch Hashem, Zachinu, Shlach et Ami v'yavduni, that tens of thousands of Russians have come back to their people, their Torah, their land, their heritage. Belevu nefesh. And he ends off the chapter with another interview with a Chabadnik speaking. And the Chabadnik says, I was talking with a Jew who saw I was a Chabadnik, a Lubavitcher Chassid, and he said to me, born or became? In Yiddish, you know how you say it, a geborene or a gewonnene? Born or became? And this Chabadnik answered, I was born when I became a Lubavitcher. Got it? Beautiful answer. And it solved all problems, all questions. A geborene or a gewonnene? Wow. I was born when I became a Chabadnik. And that also is the answer I give. I have to be honest with you. People ask me why I changed my name. And the answer is very simple. Look into Hilchat Tshuva. A Baal Tshuva has to change his name, move to a new place, say I'm not that same person. When you come in Aliyah, you're born again. So until 69, I was Rothkopf. When I became a total Baal Tshuva and returned to my people, my land, I became Rakefet, the Rambam in Hilchat Tshuva. And by the way, in Israel, they don't even realize, but they don't let you forget that Rambam. Because on every form that you fill out, you have to give two dates. Date of birth, date of Aliyah. So, time and again, Rothkopf Makaf Rakefet comes back to haunt me or inspire me. Take it as you wish. Ad kan, non-judgmental. As I began a few weeks ago, as a Litvak, as someone raised on the lap of Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelik, Rabbi Noach Bornstein, very hard for me to be non-judgmental. But I have to say, it's a powerful message from the Alter Rebbe, Perek Lamed Bet, in Sefer HaTanya. The Rav himself had both, I would say, character traits within him. He could be very judgmental from a Litvish point of view. If you study Ish Halakha, you understand what I'm saying. But on a practical level in the United States, he was non-judgmental. And there you can see it in my work on the Rebbe, Volume 2, I quote Rebbe word by word, where he said, never did I speak disparagingly to a Reformed rabbi, to a conservative rabbi. We will not win the battle by being negative. And he said, we will win the battle by setting example of ethical, moral, ritual, righteous behavior. And the Rav goes on and on to elaborate on that theme. And there too, you hear the echo of the non-judgmental attitude. It could be because the Rav and the Rebbe were both so integrated in the modern world. They had experienced the modern world. They didn't grow up in a sheltered environment. The Rebbe grew up, lo aleinu, under the communists. Think of parents weren't at his wedding. Afterwards, he's in Berlin, he's in Paris. You can't get a more open environment than those two cities. Paris was the capital of sin already from the 1870s. They were way ahead of the United States Supreme Court. London, God have mercy, Britain. The Rav. Also, how did he grow up? Chaslavich, then World War I, the communist takeover overnight. What was 90% Shomer Shabbos became 90% Mechalel Shabbos. Then he goes to Berlin, goes to Boston, they interacted with the real American scene. My Rebbeim, such as Rabbi Ruchim Gerelik, Rabbi Noach Bornstein, they didn't interact with the American scene. I told you the Vod. I think I believe I wrote this in Washington. It's one of the most insightful sentences I ever recorded in my life. Rabbi Noach Bornstein, once I was very close to my Rebbeim. I was a buddy, as the Reb says about the Holzer. We went off. Okay, good. Thank you. As the Reb says about the Holzer boys, David is my buddy at the Sheva Brachas. It's a famous recording. I also quoted it in Washington, in the Rav. I believe I quoted in Washington too, but I may be wrong. I quoted in the Rav for sure. And David says, the Rav says, David is not just my student, he's my buddy. And he's my pals. The Rav speaking, and if you don't feel your students are your pals, you cannot teach them Torah, the Rav says. You cannot teach Torah if you think you're higher than, bigger than, you have to be, your pals. I was a pal. So Rav Noach Bornstein once said to me, I hope you can appreciate the depth of this. He says, Rav Yeruchim Gerelik, Alep sich dov yet gelept in bris, is nicht dot in tree, kein dova andres. He lives here like he's in bris. Nothing has changed, except his wife buys in Alexander's. You got to understand what that meant, that his wife buys in Alexander's. But the Rav and the Rebbe, they were out in the strongholds of Western civilization, and with another judgmental attitude, you will get much further. Okay. I've now spent well over a year with lectures on the Rebbe. Some of my leading students who have achieved great things in the rabbinic world have badgered me. Rebbe, you're too positive. And they have given me a list of criticisms from here to Chernobyl.
I hope they're willing to take the criticisms in their own language.
Alex, relax, relax.
What's that?
Relax, gentlemen,
criticism
please.
Criticism is a valid intellectual.
Okay.
I agree.
One second. Relax. We're coming. Don't have any inclinations. Let's listen to what they're saying. Let's listen to the fact. Let's try to understand. And we will reach.
The reason I say it is that I myself have a lot of critiques of the Lubavitch movement, but I know that I'm coming from a place where I can also critique other movements and I can also see the strengths of it.
Okay.
And I know that there's a very sharp differentiation between the people who constantly.
They're talking to their Rebbe. And I think you know that I can be very, I love anything that's theoretic. I have to be honest that we can criticize anything. But there are at times certain faults. And maybe we can suggest, let's see what we can come up with. And let's see if this is only Chabad. You'll see what's happened. The world is shaking at this moment. That has nothing to do with Chabad. But let me begin at the beginning. I have a Talmud, Rabbi Grunstein. Now, Rabbi Grunstein's father was my Talmud in BMT. I think he was my Talmud on Rehov Neely. That's our second home. We began in Abarbanel. We were there, I think, 2 years. Then we went to Neely. We were there maybe 4 or 5 years. The Neely building doesn't exist anymore. And then the miracle happened that I was the Makabe Patish. It was really a miracle when I look back, getting this, of saying the right words to Mr. Gris. And we got this campus. So Yehoshua's father was my Talmud. And his family came in Aliyah. Yehoshua basically studied many years in Alon Shvut. He's a Talmud of Rabbi Amital, a Talmud of Rav Lichtenstein. And he's also my Talmud, but a virtual Talmud for many, many, many years. Yehoshua today heads up Rabbi Riskin's, the program Rabbi Riskin runs, I think it's called the Strauss program, if I'm not mistaken. They run a program for students to go Chutz Laretz, what Alex spoke about yesterday in such glowing terms, to go to locks, places, little places. Lach is a lach in the vod. It's a Yiddish expression. It means, you know, to be a rabbi in New York City is one thing, but to be a rabbi in Chandikover is another. So they go all over the world in Europe. The truth today is that the only ones that are really going to all these places are Lubavitch. And we'll come to that. And we, you know, the next few weeks you're going to see what we're going to deal with. And nevertheless, some places don't want a Lubavitcher. They feel Lubavitch is Chassidish. It's not for us. It's Rebbe-oriented. Whatever their reasons are. And they'll take on someone from Rabbi Riskin or a Torah Strauss program. And you go, according to what I'm told is you go, or Yeshua informed me, it's not that they tell you to go for 3-4 years. They tell you to go and stay as long as you can. Many people go, they have problems with education for children, so they can stay 3, 4, 5 years while the children are young, and then they come back. Many go till they have enough money saved to buy an apartment in Israel. I don't have to tell you, buying an apartment in Israel is a great hurdle for any young couple. And if you don't have parents who can help, and Israeli parents are geared to help, it's a very different mentality than in America. I know that I live to help my grandchildren. That's why I'm alive. I made the decision to come in Aliyah. That decision had, and my wife made the decision, let me be honest, that decision had many repercussions, that I should have my fourth grandchild is getting his paratrooper wings at the end of this month, and the Kumtah, and everyone else, as some have served in Aachen, every unit of the army imaginable. So we have to help our children, grandchildren. But this is a problem for young people who have parents who can't help, parents who have limited means. Okay. Now, I'm going to read this letter almost in toto. Chabad. As all your Talmidim, I recently heard the lectures on Chabad, their dedication and wonderful work around the world, which is truly second to none, both in scope, influence, and mesirat nefesh. However, for the sake of intellectual honesty, you see, he's quoting me, intellectual honesty, and I didn't invent that word. I got that word from the Rav. I told you, I always felt with the Rav that being intellectually dishonest was worse than eating on Yom Kippur. That's the feeling I would have. Am I right, J.J.? Right on. Okay? I must state one thing that is crucial to say. And if possible, you should see fit to talk about it in Shia. The comment has nothing to do, per se, with Chabad and the Rebbe, but the behavior of some of the Shluchim within the established communities. Now, before I go any further, I have to say, yes, we all, when we're public figures, take the Rav, take Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. I have heard such criticisms of the Rav and Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. And what's the criticisms? Some of their students have gone out, formed Chovevei Torah. They are facilitators. And they're blaming Rabbi Aaron, they're blaming the Rav for Chovevei Torah and all that's happened on the left side of the spectrum of what I call neoconservatism. Well, is it fair to blame the Rav, fair to blame Rabbi Aaron, or is it fair to blame myself? Many of their leaders are students. Natty Helfgott, I mean, sat right here in this class. I love Natty Helfgott, married a student of mine as well. Usher LaPatton, the president, was one of the best students we ever had in this classroom in the Kollel. Is it fair? So you see, there's... If you're going to blame the Rav, you're going to blame the Rebbe. Ein l'davar sof. A person has freedom of choice. We don't live in a ghetto. The Hasidic world is finding that out today. I don't have to tell you books that have been written by former Square Hasidim, Satma Hasidim. One book I read, absolute trash, unorthodox. It's sad, sad to read the way that woman thinks and what she did with her life. And she was one of many. There was a Skwerer Hasida who just, a next Skwerer Hasida, just committed suicide in New York, if you know what's going on. And it's a tragedy. We live, we are influenced by two worlds. Willy-nilly, no one can escape this. So there are more influences on you than just the Rav and just the Rebbe and just Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and just Chris Kollel. There are many more influences. And I don't know if it's entirely fair to blame the Rav, the Rebbe. And why not be positive? Look at their success. Against all odds, the Rebbe changed the picture of Torah in the entire world. And that's a fact. Look at the Rav against all odds. He created, a guy came over to me in shul, a survivor from Hungary. He never attended any of my shiur, but he heard about me, he heard about my classes, and he came over to me and he said, "The world is so amazed. You're a third generation American and you're so devoted to learning, to teaching, to learning, to Shas." I looked at him. But is it fair to blame? Be positive. Look what the Baron Lichtenstein did in the heads of the world. You can blame him from today to tomorrow. Some of the graduates of Michlala, they just had a piece this weekend on Yochi Brandreis. She was my student in Michlala. Shem Yirachem, where she is today. So you're going to blame Rabbi Koopman? She was running away from a Haredi background. All right. Halavai, we could have put brakes on. You all know, if I meet kids, I've had kids in the Kollel, Talmidim, running away from the Haredi world. So I would say to them, are you my Talmid to run away, or my Talmid to come to Torah Hashem Tamima? And if they said to me, of course, they'd give me the answer I want to hear, Torah Hashem Tamima. Right? Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem. So I don't know if it's fair to blame, but there is a problem he raises here, which is very well. Behavior of the shluchim within the established communities, while there are wonderful and far out places around the world, when they enter a community that already has rabbis, shuls, mikvahs, schools, they act in a manner that can be summed up in one phrase: my way or the highway. In a word, they believe that until you and I become Lubavitchers, we are not fully good Jews as of yet. They believe that only their way is the right way. Well, this can be harmless if you think about it, and only think about it. On a practical level, it causes endless damages in the Jewish communities around the world. I can give many examples, all true stories from our graduates, but here are a few. Now, I'm going to quote some of these examples, and these are real life examples, and these are absolutely authentic and accurate. And you see, here you come to a very delicate problem, which I encountered already when I was your age. Some Lubavitchers have a haughty attitude. I'll use that word, or a supercilious attitude. And they believe there are two types of Jews, we used to say. Either you're a Lubavitcher, you'll become a Lubavitcher. The implication is that something is lacking in you if you're not a Lubavitcher. And you'll see from these examples, it can have frightening practical results. Now, I want to say something very sharp. I want to express an idea to you that I think is irrefutable. 1980, the Rav went to the Fabrengen celebrating 30 years that the Rebbe was the head of Chabad, the Nasi. It's not exactly 30 years, it's 29 years, but really it is 30 years because, as you saw from my lectures, when the sixth Rebbe died, almost from the first minute on, the heart of Lubavitch gathered around the younger son-in-law, Reb Menachem Mendel. And he really became the Rebbe, I can understand, celebrating 30 years in 1980, although the first Maima Devar Elokim that he said, which indicated he was now the Rebbe, was in 1951. All right? So the Rebbe came to this Fabrengen. Here are two men who were born so distant from the United States. Here are two men who learned English perhaps as a sixth or seventh language. Just think for a minute. Here are two men who went through so much struggle in life, and yet, what achievements. Tell me, when they shook hands and embraced each other, at that moment, and we have this on video clippage, and I know people who were there, I couldn't be there, Dafka was in America at the time, but I was a shaliach or a shaluach of the Jewish agency of the Israeli government to Denver, Colorado, to the University of Denver. But I heard about it, and some of my own Talmidim accompanied the Rav to that Fabrengen. Tell me, do you think they looked down upon each other? Do you think the Rebbe thought Rabbi Soloveitchik is not yet a Chabadnik? And do you think the Rebbe thought the Rebbe is secondary because he's a Chabadnik, a Chassid, not a pure Litvak? What do you think? I think Chas v'Chalila, we should imagine that they look down upon each other. I think they embraced with mutual love, affection, respect, and awe for what each one had achieved. And that's my outlook. I don't know which is better. I don't know if the word better applies. All I know is that all of us are obligated, commanded, we must obey the halacha, the Vach Hashem. When it comes to emotion, when it comes to thought, when it comes to intellect and what interests us, it's an open Gemara. Everyone is different. You all know the Gemara at the end of Brachot. Kishem shepeneim en andamat, patsufeim en andamat, deoteim en andamat. You make a bracha that God has created so many individuals, the Mishnah and Sanhedrin. Ribbono shel Olam, one human being, and out of one human being, everyone is so different. Physically, mentally, emotionally, biologically, intellectually. So Baruch Hashem, look at Chazal. In Chazal you will find endless differences of opinion on intellectual issues, on emotional issues, on belief. I mean, it's endless, and they'll never paskin. The one time they attempted to paskin, Tovel Adam Shenivra or Shalonivra, and they finally reached the conclusion, yeah, they're both right. Better man shouldn't have been created, but now that it's created, he has to make the best of it. That's essentially telling us both viewpoints are right. And to me, this is the heart of understanding Yiddishkeit. And this is where I can never be part of the Haredi world as we see it today, where everyone is criticizing the other one. And halavai, the day will come, and I hope it's coming, that more and more people recognize how beautiful it is to be a Jew. And their different views, values, coloration, configuration, Yud Beit Shvatim, with a Shah Klali on top of it, the Ariha Kodesh. This is the heart of what Torah is about. So I have to tell you, when it comes to the Rav and the Rebbe, you just think for a minute they're embracing. No? Do you think that each one is thinking the other one is off the path slightly? Because he doesn't live in my world? To me, such thoughts don't even begin. And this is the way we should approach, in my humble opinion, is the way my Rebbe approached Chabad. Beautiful. Everyone can be a Chabadnik, not everyone. I personally, I can't have a Rebbe in that sense. I'm too independent. My Rebbeim raised me to be independent. You know what went on in Lithuania? You know what went on in the yeshiva? You look at the pictures of Slabodka, look at the pictures of Kells. No two people wore the same type of hats. Right or wrong? Pictures don't lie. It's not computer pictures from this generation. You can't believe any picture.
But it
indicates, it's a tangible expression, very different than the Hasidic world.
I think Frankfurt School would argue that that's perhaps an expression of pseudo-individuality.
What do you mean the Frankfurt School? Who are you referring to?
Max Horkheimer, Theodore Adorno.
I'm just making a point that oftentimes
people, I think that those things are signs. I, having been part of every community, just about every community in the Torah world, and learned in five different types of yeshivas, Sephardi, Chabad, Litvish, everywhere, and I'm saying every group has its shtick, and if you look at it that way, you'll see the same dynamics playing out everywhere. But the modern Orthodox world also has all of its own...
I don't think
the average person is really so much more individual there than they...
Someone once asked me, he said, why do you say that your world is so individualistic? Aren't they all wearing kippot srugot? So I answered on the spot. I said, show me two kippot srugot that are exactly the same. Follow, these are not Bosalina hats. You're saying who cares, but I answered his question very powerfully. But you can take that as a symbolism, which I think it is. There's a big difference between the world I was raised in, the Hasidic world. And I can have the love and admiration and the greatest respect, but we're all equal. Ultimately, halan beseta, that has to be our goal. How do we serve the Ribbono Shel Olam?
The fact that the Rebbe and the Rav had such outstanding respect for one another, I think that simply begs the question. We can't use that as a mechanism to whitewash the defects in Chabad,
The Hefek, you don't need me. I'm not whitewashing the defects. I'm trying to show what we should teach our Jews, be they Chabadnikim or YU people, etc., etc. And this concept that I'm better than you, to me, doesn't get off the floor. And I want to prove it, because the Lubavitcher will say to me, I heard this one, that one, the Rebbe and the Rav. You mean the Rebbe looked down upon the Rav because he wasn't a Chabadnik and vice versa?
No, we were dealing with the critique that was presented here.
I haven't presented any.
That the phenomenon exists within Chabad.
Right, absolutely. I'm going to show you examples. But I'm trying to show you what my approach is and what the proper approach has to be. And I want to tell you a very interesting story. A number of years ago, I was scholar in residence in Seattle. Seattle, Washington, right? It's part of Washington State. I had been in Los Angeles, and from there I flew to Seattle. So at the time I came to Seattle, I never saw such a vibrant Orthodox community which had no machloket whatsoever at the time. Unfortunately, the rafters were shaken up, and I think I've told you the story how machlokes came there, and it's a very sad story. I'll tell it to you in a second. So I saw the community is very interesting. Two big shuls right next to each other, like around the corner from each other. One, the Sephardi shul, and one the Ashkenazi shul. And these were the two biggest shuls in Seattle. We're talking hundreds and hundreds of people. And when I spoke, everyone came to hear me. Hundreds of people. What a crowd. And it's Seattle. We're not talking now Borough Park or Kew Gardens Hills. And as a matter of fact, I'll tell you a cute story. The rabbi of the Sephardic Shul, who's well into his 90s, Rabbi Maimon, Solomon Maimon, he was, he jumped, he danced around me, he hugged me, he kissed me. Why? Because I told the following story. I said, I see Rabbi Maimon has honored me with his presence. You know, he's the revered senior rabbi of Seattle. And I said, you don't know the story about him. He was a Talmud in the yeshiva. He had studied with Reb Moshe Soloveitchik. When Reb Moshe died so suddenly and the Rav took over the shir, he's in the shir with the Rav. Oh, you've got to know Yiddish to appreciate this. And Maimon opens his mouth and says some svara. Obviously, in those days, every Sephardi had to know Yiddish to survive in a yeshiva. My classmate was Katzin, the son of the chief rabbi. He knew Yiddish as well as I did. He studied with the Rav. So Maimon and the Rav yells at him, Maimon, du plugged svi a Turk. You're babbling like a Turk. That's a Yiddish expression that the Turks used to, I don't know why they babbled more than anyone else, but that's the Yiddish expression. And the Rav yells at him, Maimon, du babbles svi a Turk. And the whole class breaks into laughter. And the Rav goes, Was Lachman? You know, the Rav then would get hysterical. This is the Rav with his temper and youth. Was Lachman? I wasn't there, but I can understand. I see just what happened. What's everyone laughing at? And one kid gets up. He says, Rebbe, Maimon is a Turk. And the Rav asked him, where are you from? It turned out he was from Turkey, and the whole story. And you know, the whole class, it was a moment of jest in the whole class. So I told that story in Seattle. And Rabbi Maimon, you know, how did you know it? How did you know it? And, you know, he was beaming. I hope he's well. He has to be pushing 100 today. He was beaming. I know the story when I did my research on the Rav and I tried to get hold of all the Talmidim from 41 on. So you get certain stories. I mean, I have stories on Rabbi Maimon, Rabbi Kanatopsky. These were the giants of the 1940s. So I got to know the people in Seattle. And they said something very interesting to me. They said, in our kehila, there is no machlokes. The Sfadim, the Ashkenazim, have gotten along from time immemorial. And the Chabatnikim opened in an area like towards the suburbs and the suburbs of Seattle. There were no Orthodox shuls there. They opened where there were only temples. And we get along fabulously. B'shalom u'b'shalva. So you see, that's a very interesting comment from Seattle. And you'll see from all the examples I'll give you next week where the problems begin, where there's an established shul. And what is the attitude of the established shul to the Chabatnik? And of course, vice versa. How does the Chabatnik treat the established shul? The story of how Machloket came to Seattle is beyond belief, worthy of a novel. 9/11 shook up the entire world, although many people have attempted to forget it. It brought Machloket to Seattle. What happened was a very prominent member of the community was caught on a business trip. And if you recall, when 9/11 broke, they shut down all the airports all over the United States and Canada. People were in a panic. And this guy, you know, the world, everyone thought the world was coming to an end. You got to remember, who could believe the Twin Towers are crumpled to dust with people jumping out of the windows to their death, all on television all over the world. So this individual, finally they reopened the airport a week later, and the only flight he could get back to Seattle would bring him in on Shabbos. And this was a frum guy. For whatever the reasons, he decided to take the flight. He was desperate to get home, and he took the flight. This person had a chazakah of blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah. And the rabbi said, how can he blow shofar? Chalos Shabbos. He wouldn't let him blow. No, this balabas made up his mind when the next
This is the Ashkenazi or Sephardi shul.
Excuse me?
This is the Ashkenazi
shul. When the next contract, the rabbi's contract expires and we have to renegotiate, he was going to fight the rabbi, and he succeeded. But a large element loved the rabbi. The rabbi himself was a very fascinating individual of photographic memory, Talmud of Rabban Soloveitchik. Every shiur he would begin with a question. I heard him speak, very nice. And he didn't always answer. He said, think about it. There may be many answers. Let's see what you come up with. He would engage the people in what he was talking about. But that machloket divided the community. And unfortunately, it is still divided until today. Seattle is a very interesting community. It's produced many rabbis, many prominent, good, wonderful Jews. Rabbi Fram of Baltimore, the famous Rabbi Fram, F-R-A-N-D, right? The famous Rabbi Fram is from that community. The Rabbi Lubans, who just died recently, Zichrono Livracha, saintly rabbi, young Israel of Forest Hills, he grew up in Seattle. The Gnauer family, it's a very famous name in Orthodoxy. They are part of the Seattle story. And who else here?
The Rusak family.
I can't hear?
Rusak.
Who's Rusak?
They're also...
A well-to-do family, but I'm the Rabbanim are the ones I know. The people with that are well-to-do. That's what the YU fundraisers have to know. But Seattle, what a community. But Chabad went to the suburbs. So I want to reiterate, we're just scratching the surface, and I trust I'll reach it next week. I will blow your minds with one source that indicates that the Rebbe is computer-wise, which I thank my Talmud from the Kollel, David Katz, living in West Hempstead today. He moved from Kew Gardens Hills to West Hempstead. Should I be happy or sad? Which is closer to the airport that will bring him to Israel? Think about it.
You'd like him to abandon all the people that he's teaching Torah to?
I'm happy to hear you're giving him credit for teaching Torah, doing mitzvah. He happens to be the public relations boy Friday for the head of the social network of Satmar. It's Rabbi Niederman's boy Friday. You follow? He's the clean-shaven individual who speaks perfect Yiddish and an Ungarish, perfect English and an Ungarish Yiddish, and he's worked for Satmar for many years now. I think it's already a lifetime assignment. So you have a modern Orthodox person living in West Hempstead. You don't live in West Hempstead if you're Satmar. And he works for Satmar, believe in that. She's a great individual. And he made it possible for me to shock you from here to 770. I hope next week we'll reach it, Bezrat Hashem. So to reiterate, what did we finish out today? We finished out the Rebbe. We finished out the non-judgmental, the positivism, the heart of the Rebbe, being Makarif people. Is it enough just to put on tefillin? The sad story of Mili, who didn't reach Tarat Mishpacha. The information that my students supplied me with from around the world. And we finally have a portrait of Jerome Mintz. And that's where I hit Alex very hard earlier, following our dialogue of yesterday. Then you'll pick it up on the. Then we began a new topic, which is going to take a little while, the critique of Chabad. And I just wanted to make clear today, I ended off the class with a very interesting analogy, the Rav and the Rebbe, 1980. That's the way I approach it. But Chabadnikim on the ground, yesh v'yesh, as we will see. Okay, now next Sunday, we pick up again right where we left off. It is going to be one of the most fascinating shirim I've ever given, what Reb Menashe Klein brings into the world of responsa literature and the questions he raises. And you got to think about them. And I'll go on to tell you a good story with Reb Aaron Lichtenstein that brings it all home in a very tangible fashion. And we have a world of freebies. Okay, whoever's interested, this is the extension of the Bal Harbor Shul. It's unbelievable what they plan. I have two copies of this article. That's the Chabad. Two pictures remain of the Rav and Rav David Lifshitz, whoever wants. An article by a shlucha from Berlin, from Ami magazine. Very interesting. A memoir of someone sneaking in and getting a peek of the fifth Rebbe and the sixth Rebbe as private individuals. Very, very interesting. New York Times article on the compromise reached about a different part of the Kotel being open to reform, conservative, mixed, women of the wall, mixed seating, etc. How the New York Times describes it. Jewish Week article, Mortimer Zuckerman, God bless him, is giving $100 million to scientific plans or scientific resources in Israel to stem the Israeli academic brain drain. In other words, to bring back top quality people who can come to Israel, return to Israel, and make their contributions here. This is a very interesting article on Harrisburg Synagogue, which is called in English Kesha Israel, which is a terrible, what does that mean, revolt of Israel, when the real name is Keter Israel, Crown of Israel, and yet for 100+ years it's called Kesha Israel. The rabbi did research and reached, I agree with his conclusion 100%, and I thank the rabbi for quoting my scholarship in it. This is Rabbi Eugene Borowitz, just died, a big reform leader, who had a bit of Chazara Tshuva in his life. Fascinating. This is Efrat.
Granddaughter is a Wexner fellow in my
it's
class.
It's a Wexner fellow, and where does she stand religiously?
She's also reformed. She's also studying in
the HUC. In HUC, and not Shomeret Shabbat.
No.
No, wow, that's hard. It hurts. But at least she's Jewish. Okay, Kanayin Hara, you can get one. Halavai, we have to complete the picture. Tzegatzalait. Efrat brings gender equality to the synagogue. You can maledict the Rebbe named Brakefet. The rabbi is my student. That woman is married to my student. Was a student in the Kollel. Chutkov. The Bekasha worn by Rabbi Yisrael Friedman, one of the Ruzhin Rebbeim that survived the Holocaust. Wow. Documents buried by Jewish prisoners of Auschwitz tell the stories of genocide. This speaks about the Jews who had to lift the dead bodies out of the crematorium, and they found records of how they thought, and these people, wow. This is about Israel today from the Jerusalem Report. The new Zionist, it's like quoting Rakefet, how the Haredim, it's amazing, they're going to college, going to the army, going to work, and they retain their Harediyut, if I may use that term, Kol HaKavod. An article on Professor Tversky, a career in law that almost didn't happen. An article for Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, how to respond to how we will use what we learn in school in the real world. It deals with Shakespeare, etc. This will leave for next week. And this is an article you won't believe, I'm ashamed to mention it, from the New York Times Magazine, by a scam across America when you call a locksmith to pick your lock, what Israelis living in America are capable of pulling off. Wow. My dear students, thank you for your attendance. Ma'achkim et rabam. And that's the secret of teaching the Gemara in Tainus, Daf Zayin Amud Aleph. And I rebuke all the thousands listening across the world. We are waiting for you in Jerusalem, until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya.